trembled only slightly. Rodriguez reached up and grabbed the beacon, ripped it free, and worked his arms into the climbing harness. Then he snapped its fasteners shut and gave the tether an experimental tug. It felt strong. Good. He started to reach for the control stud that would activate the winch. Then he caught himself. "Weight one," he whispered in the clipped tone of the professional flyer. He bent down and picked up the beacon. Sliding it open to its full length, he worked its pointed end into a crack in the basalt rock face. "It probably won't stay in place for long," he thought, "and it won't work at all unless the sun shines on it for a few hours per day." But he felt satisfied that he had left a reminder that men from Earth had been here, had entered the pit and gleaned at least some of its secrets and survived. "Okay," he said to himself, grasping the tether with one hand. "Here we go." He pushed on the control stud and was hauled off his feet. Grinding, twisting, grating, he felt himself pulled up the rock slope, his head banging inside his helmet, his legs and booted feet bouncing as he was dragged upward. Worse than any simulator ride he'd ever been through in training. Worse than the high-G centrifuge they'd whirled him in. "They'll never put this ride into Disneyland," Rodriguez thought, teeth clacking as he bounced, jounced, jolted up the lip of the caldera. At last it was over. Rodriguez lay panting, breathless, aching. Fuchida's hard-suited form lay on the ground next to him, unmoving. Rodriguez rolled over on one side, as far as his backpack would allow. Beyond Fuchida's dark silhouette, the sky was filled with stars. Dazzling, bright, friendly stars gleaming down at him, like a thousand jewels, like heaven itself. "I made it," Rodriguez told himself. Then he corrected. "Not yet. Can't say that yet." He touched his helmet to Fuchida's. "Hey, Mitsuo, you okay?" It was an inane question, and he knew it. Fuchida made no response, but Rodriguez could hear the biologist's breathing, panting, really, shallow and fast. "Gotta get him to the plane. Can't do a thing for him out here." As quickly as he could, Rodriguez unbuckled the climbing harness, then tenderly lifted the unconscious Fuchida and struggled to his feet. "Good thing we're on Mars. I could never lift him in a suit and a full G. Now where the hell is the plane?" In the distance he saw the single red eye of another one of the Geomet beacons they had planted. He headed in that direction, tenderly carrying his companion in his arms. "I couldn't do this for you, Luis," Rodriguez said silently. "I wish I could have. But this is the most I can do." Midnight. Sol 49 and 50. The base dome was dark and silent, its lighting turned down to sleep shift level, its plastic skin opaqued to prevent heat from leaking out into the Martian night. Stacy Dejerova was still sitting at the comm console, drowsing despite herself, when Rodriguez's call came through. "We're back in the plane," the astronaut announced without preamble. "Let me talk to Vijay."
"Vijay!"
Stacy shouted in a voice that shattered the sleepy silence.
"Jamie!" she added.
Running footsteps padded through the shadows, bare or stockinged feet against the plastic flooring. Vijay slipped into the chair beside Dejerova, her jet-black eyes wide open and alert. Jamie and Trudy Hall raced in, bleary-eyed, and stood behind the two women.
"This is Vijay," she said. "What's your condition?"
In the display screen, they could see only the two men's helmets and shoulders. Their faces were masked by the heavily tinted visors, but Rodriguez's voice sounded steady, firm.
"I'm okay. Banged up a little, but that's nothing. I purged Mitsuo's suit and plugged him into the plane's emergency air supply, but he's still out of it."
"How long ago did you do that?" Vijay asked, her dark face rigid with tension.
15-16 minutes ago."
"And you're just calling in now?" Dejerova demanded.
"I had to fix his battery pack," Rodriguez answered, unruffled by her tone. "It got disconnected when he was knocked down."
"Knocked down?" Jamie blurted.
"Yeah, that was when he hurt his ankle."
"How badly is he hurt?" Vijay asked.
"It's sprained, at least. Maybe a break."
"He couldn't break a bone inside the suit," Jamie muttered. "Not with all that protection." "Anyway," Rodriguez resumed,
His suit wasn't getting any power. I figured that getting his suit powered up was the second most important thing to do. Pumping fresh air into him was the first.
And calling in the third, Dezhurova said, much more mildly.
Right, said Rodriguez.
I'm getting his readouts, Vijay said, studying the medical diagnostic screen.
Yeah, his suit's okay now that the battery's reconnected.
Is his LCG working? Vijay asked.
Should be, Rodriguez said. Wait one. They saw the astronaut lean over and touch his helmet to the unconscious Fuchida's shoulder.
Yep, he announced after a moment.
I can hear the pump chugging. Water ought to be circulating through his long johns just fine.
That should bring his temperature down, Vijay muttered, half to herself. The problem is, he might be in shock from overheating.
What do I do about that? Rodriguez asked. The physician shook her head.
Not much you can do, mate, especially with the two of you sealed into your suits.
For a long moment, they were all silent. Vijay stared at the medical screen. Fuchida's temperature was coming down, heart rate slowing nicely, breathing almost normal. He should be... The biologist coughed and stirred.
What happened? He asked weakly.
All four of the people at the comm center broke into grins. None of them could see Rodriguez's face behind his visor, but they heard the relief in his voice.
Now, Mitsuo, you're supposed to ask, where am I?
The biologist sat up straighter.
Is Trudy here?
Don't worry about...
I'm right here, Mitsuo,
said Trudy Hall, leaning in between Dezhurova and Vijay.
What is it?
Siderophiles, Fuchida exclaimed. Ion-eating bacteria live in the caldera.
Did you get samples?
Yes, of course.
Jamie stepped back as the two biologists chattered together. Fuchida nearly gets himself killed, but what's important to him is finding a new kind of organism. With an inward smile, Jamie admitted, maybe he's right. Balloons. Before the explorers landed on the surface of Mars, while they were still in orbit, goggling at the rusty, worn immensity of the red planet, they released the balloons. 6 wine-case-sized capsules retrofired from their orbiting supply vessel and blazed into the thin Martian atmosphere, then released a dozen balloons each. The balloons were brilliantly simple, little more than long, narrow tubes of exquisitely thin yet tough mylar, inflated with hydrogen gas automatically when they reached the proper altitude to float across the landscape like improbable giant white cigarettes. Dangling below each long, thin balloon was a snake, a flexible, slim metal pipe that contained sensing instruments, radio, batteries, and a heater to protect the equipment against the frigid weather. By day, the balloons wafted high in the Martian atmosphere, sampling the temperature, low, pressure, lower, humidity, lower still, and chemical composition of the air. The altitude at which any individual balloon flew was governed by the amount of hydrogen filling its slender cigarette shape. The daytime winds carried them across the red landscape like dandelion puffs. At night, when the temperatures became so frigid that even the hydrogen inside the balloons began to condense, they all sank toward the ground like a chorus of ballerinas tiredly drooping. Often the snakes of instruments actually touched the ground and dutifully transmitted data on the surface conditions each night, while the balloons bobbed in the dark winds, still buoyant enough to hover safely above the rock-strewn ground. Barely. Similar balloons had been a major success during the first Mars expedition, even though many of them eventually snagged on mountainsides or disappeared for reasons unknown. Most drifted gracefully across the face of Mars for weeks on end, descending slowly each night and rising again when the morning sunlight warmed their hydrogen-filled envelopes, carrying on silently, effortlessly, living with the Martian day-night cycle and faithfully reporting on the environment from pole to pole. Morning, Sol 50. Jamie was not surprised to see his grandfather waiting for him in the cliff village. He remembered climbing down from the rim of the canyon, then slowly and deliberately taking off his hard suit once he had reached the niche in the cliff face. He felt warm and safe walking through the silent ruins in nothing more than his coveralls. Grandfather Al